Thank you very much, Ben, for reading that letter, and I would like to talk with you for a bit about that letter in Revelation 3, verses 7 through 13. The letter to the congregation at Philadelphia. Philadelphia in Pennsylvania is, I think, the fifth largest city in the United States at this time, after New York, L.A., Chicago, and I think Houston just recently joined that list as number four. Philadelphia, as I think you all know, means brotherly love. It's the city of brotherly love, and when we hear about it in our own country, it conjures up images of William Penn and the Quakers and Benjamin Franklin, etc. The Philadelphia to which this letter was written was in Asia Minor. It was 28 miles east-southeast of the city of Sardis, and it was the most recently established of all the seven cities that are referred to in these two chapters, Revelation chapters 2 and 3. It was founded around 140 B.C. by King Attalus II of Pergamum. Attalus II was nicknamed Philadelphos because of his great love for his brother Eumenes. So this city he founded was called Philadelphia, brotherly love, after Attalus II, Philadelphos. Each one of these congregations that's mentioned in these chapters is unique, and Philadelphia is unique from all the others. These are samples of the kinds of churches that have existed throughout the Christian era and which will continue to exist as long as the world stands. There is a church in the among these seven that fought valiantly against error and hated evil, but was condemned because of a lack of love. There was another church which exhibited love only to be condemned for the lack of sound doctrine and a toleration of sin. There is a church among these seven which was spiritually alive in every way, only to be killed physically, martyred for Christ. There's another one of these churches that was physically alive in every way, but was spiritually killed by sin. There's one of these churches that thought it was poor, but God said it was rich. And there's another one of these churches that thought it was rich, but God said it was poor, destitute of holy things. So there are all different kinds of churches among these seven, and that's the way the church always is. Only two of these seven were really very good, and those were Smyrna and Philadelphia. A couple of months ago, I talked with you about Smyrna, and that's why today, as a companion piece, I wanted to talk with you about Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, we find a church that was given no rebuke by the Lord. It was a lampstand faithfully holding up the light. Faithful Philadelphia didn't need any warning or any chastisement or any threatening. And I like to imagine the congregation in Philadelphia as they heard this letter read to them for the first time. Probably it was not a large congregation. The actual town itself had few inhabitants because it was such an unsafe place to live for reasons that I hope to explore with you just shortly. But I don't know whether they originally had just this letter or whether they had the entire apocalypse, including all of the other letters as well. I suspect they may have had the entire thing, though. And if they did, and they heard the letters read to them in order, then in Philadelphia, they may just have waited as their letter was read for that one bad paragraph that never came. Because in almost every one of these other letters, there was at least one bad paragraph. But it never came in Philadelphia because the Lord found nothing there that he was going to rebuke. The city of Philadelphia was established on the boundary lines of three different countries, Mysia and Lydia and Phrygia. And as a border town, it was regarded as the gateway to the east, similarly to the way that St. Louis was regarded as the gateway to the west. So this was the gateway to the east, and it was built on the edge of a volcanic area that was known as the Burnt Land or the Burnt District, where for miles and miles a huge volcano had deposited burning lava all over the place. We might wonder why it was established there. Philadelphia was established with the deliberate intention of being a missionary city for Hellenism, that is, the spreading of Greek culture and Greek language and Greek way of life to fulfill the dream of Alexander the Great. It was established for only that reason. And according to William Ramsay, the success of Philadelphia in its mission is attested by the fact that before 19 AD, the native Lydian language was entirely gone, and the only language that was left in the country was the Greek language. Maybe you've been in places, I have, where the traditional dialectic languages are fading from the scene, and another language is taking over. It's a very interesting time. Philadelphia was regarded as the city of the open door. When the Lord said in the 8th verse to this church, I have set before thee an open door, they knew that he was spiritualizing a concept which municipally applied to them very well. And once again, we see a characteristic of a city in the church within that city. If we were to look at the letter of Sardis, which we're not going to have time to do, but if we were to look at that, we would have to talk about the tremendous earthquake that occurred in A.D. 17. This is the one that Pliny, who wrote about it, described as the greatest disaster in human memory. Now, I'm sure he was overemphasizing it when he said that, but he was of that magnitude that he called it the greatest disaster in human memory, an earthquake in 17 A.D. It devastated 12 cities in this area, including Sardis and Philadelphia. Sardis and Philadelphia were the two nearest cities to the volcanic district. And while Sardis is said to have been the worst hit by this earthquake, Philadelphia was prominent among those whose tribute was remitted for 5 years so that they could recover from the earthquake. The interesting thing about the earthquake, so far as Philadelphia was concerned, is that it suffered aftershocks and tremors from this earthquake for at least 12 years after it, or a number of years afterward. Strabo, the geographer, said that Philadelphia didn't even have its walls secure because, quote, they never cease being cracked, end quote. He also said, quote, they are daily shaken and split in some degree, end quote. And he said, quote, the people continually pay attention to earth tremors and plan their buildings with this factor in mind, end quote. And finally, Strabo said, quote, different parts of the city are constantly suffering damage. That is why the actual town has few inhabitants, but the majority live as farmers in the countryside as they have fertile land. But one is surprised even at the few, that is the few who live in the actual town itself. He said, one is surprised even at the few that they are so fond of the place where they have such insecure dwellings, end quote. Now, of course, Turkey, this area of Turkey that we're talking about where this town was, it's called Turkey today, 98% Muslim today. And the earthquakes in this area have continued right on up to our present time. In fact, when Colin Hemer was writing about Philadelphia, he talked about having visited Philadelphia right after a major earthquake on March the 29th, 1969. He tells about the total collapse of lots of farmhouses and lots of tents erected for the homeless by the Red Crescent. The Red Crescent is that branch of the Red Cross that operates in Muslim countries because you can't have it be the Red Cross, which would be offensive to those people. So it's the Red Crescent. And there have been lots of earthquakes in this area since that time. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been involved in an earthquake. I'm sure that some of you have. Not long ago, I asked in Southern California to an audience like this, how many of them had ever been in an earthquake, and virtually every hand went up. That wouldn't happen here. Let me just see. How many of you have ever been in an earthquake in your life? Just a few of you have, and some of you did that in Southern California. So we're not really that experienced with the idea of earthquakes, but it can be a very traumatic thing. During and after an earthquake, people seek refuge in the open air. At Philadelphia, this had just become a way of life for these people. Many of them lived outside the city and farmed the fertile volcanic soil. Those who remained in the city itself tried to constantly repair the damage, but they'd have to flee the city when the new tremors would come. They remained in their missionary zeal, but they were regarded by many as gamblers who were a little touched in the head even for living there. Strabo said, quote, one is surprised at them for living there. The point is, there was no security in this town. And when Jesus promised the overcomer at Philadelphia that he should go no more out, that's exactly what he was talking about. That was a wonderful way of expressing the eternal security of the person who is faithful to the end. Yes, we believe in eternal security. We believe in it for people who are faithful unto death, people who are faithful until death, faithful until the end of life. It's also interesting that the name of this city was changed more than once. The citizens were so grateful to Tiberius, not only for remitting their taxes, but also for giving them extra money to rebuild their city, that they helped erect a monument to Tiberius and change the name of their city to Neo-Caesarea after Tiberius, who was one of the Caesars. At a later time, they again changed the name to Flavia after Vespasian, who was of the Flavian family, and may have bailed them out of a similar disaster in his day. And so it was a new city with a new name to honor the divine emperor whose patronage had restored it. Let's look at the letter then just very briefly. Notice here, first of all, in this letter in verse 7, that the Lord does not draw his description of himself from chapter 1. Now, that's unique. In the other letters, he draws his description of himself from something in chapter 1. But here he does not do that. Instead, he uses a very Hebrew, very Old Testament type of description in verse 7. These things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David. He that openeth and no man shutteth and no man openeth. Holy is the word hagios, of course, meaning to be set apart or different. It's the idea of sanctification. If you're God's person, you are set apart for God and belong to him. Jesus is holy and gives us that example. Be ye holy as I am holy. He is also true. Not just true as opposed to false, although he is that, but he's genuine or real as opposed to unreal. In Plato's idea of this, there was another world someplace where there was a perfect everything. We've got chairs in this world that are imperfect copies of the real true chair in Plato's postulated world. Everybody here is an imperfect copy of the real man in Plato's world. And that's the idea here. Our world is only imperfect imitations of the truth. But one came who said, I am the truth. And that's what this is talking about here, the one who is true. All that a real man could be expected to be, better than John Wayne, better than Clark Gable, better than the governor of California. He is better than anybody who is a man on this earth at this time. He's God's idea of a real man, Jesus Christ. He's holy and true, different and real. And he has the key of David. In other words, the authority of David's throne. I set before you an open door, he says in verse 8. You're living in a city called the city of the open door, but I set before you an open door to take the gospel to the heathen. The door was a symbol of opportunity in this kind of symbolic language. An open door referred to an opportunity that is present, like when Paul said, a great door and effectual is open unto me, and there are many adversaries in 1 Corinthians 16:9. A shut door is a symbol of an opportunity that used to be present, but now it's past. It's been lost. Noah built the ark. He and his family went into the ark, and God shut the door. The opportunity was past. Gerald was talking about the 10 virgins as depicted in Matthew 25. Five of them were wise, five of them were otherwise. The bridegroom came, and they that were ready, what a statement that is. They that were ready went into the marriage, and the door was shut, meaning that the opportunity was passed. Later, when other people pounded on it, that door would not be opened unto them. I am he that openeth, and no man shutteth, and shutteth, no man openeth. I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut in. It was an evangelistic opportunity, an open door for missionary work that they had. Now, here's his commendation of them. Thou hast a little strength. They may not have been a very large congregation, perhaps quite small, but they were mighty in spiritual strength. Never worry if you come from a congregation that's small. Congregations ebb and flow. They get bigger and then they get littler. All sorts of things happen. Jesus said, fear not, little flock. And he would say that to us as well. Paul said, when I am weak, then am I strong. Thou hast kept my word. They were obedient to the word that the Lord had given them. That's all any of us can really be expected to do. That's what God requires. They were obedient to the scriptures. Thou hast not denied my name. This is loyalty. This is the perseverance of the saints, as he puts it later on in chapter 14, verse 12. In verse 10, he says, thou hast kept the word of my patience. Now, that's a reference to their endurance. Through thick and thin, instant in season and out of season, they endured steadfastly through good times and bad. The Lord says, you've kept the word of my patience. In other words, you have done it the way that I did it. I did it, I was an example to you, and now you have done it the same way. You have followed my command and my example. What a wonderful thing to be in a congregation that gets a letter like this written to them. In verse 9, he references the synagogue of Satan. Now, back in the book of Psalms, the synagogue of God was referred to in Psalm 74, verse 8. I think the idea here that we have, and this is not the only letter where the synagogue of Satan is referred to, It's the idea that the Jewish synagogue was still continuing, but it was no longer viewed as the synagogue of God, because a distinction had been made with the ushering in of the gospel. And we find that distinction clearly delineated, of course, in the second chapter of the Roman letter. He is not a Jew who is one outwardly, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. So here are people who say they are Jews, but they're not really, from God's point of view, they're not really Jews at all. They're liars from a spiritual point of view. We've talked about the synagogue of Satan before, I think, and I won't repeat all of that here. We don't really know very much about the Jews in Philadelphia during this time period. We do know, though, that just a few miles away in the neighboring city of Sardis, it was a tremendous center of the diaspora, the great dispersion of the Jewish people. There was a great synagogue there that's been found by archaeologists, and it's likely that Philadelphia, since it had such turbulent circumstances all the time, it would be a great economic opportunity for the selling of necessities at exorbitant prices. It's very likely that there was a sizable Jewish community here as well. And once again, the Lord provoked, if they were listening and looking, he provoked the Jews to jealousy through the Gentiles once again. I will make them to bow at your feet. The idea here is the honor and respect shown by a humbled, defeated enemy. This was going to transpire. This church, it seems like, just came as close as possible to being all that the Lord wants one of his congregations to be. In verse 10, the words keep and kept appear quite frequently, and we see that the keepers are the kept. You have kept the word of my patience, I will also keep thee from the hour of trial or temptation. The keepers are the kept. I will keep you from the future test. You know, sometimes when you take a class in school, if you're a good student, you're even allowed to skip the final because you have nothing left to prove. You've already demonstrated your capacity in the subject, so there's nothing left to test you over. The test exposes you for what you are, but if you already totally revealed what you are, then in some classes you wouldn't even need to take the final test. These people had already made clear what they were. They had passed the test as the Lord was viewing them. In verse 11, he says, I come quickly, meaning, I believe, I come quickly in this trial that's about to transpire. Remember there, when the Lord's talking about coming quickly, it's not a coming of Christ is not always the same thing as an appearance of Christ. The coming of Christ in the New Testament is not always what we call the second coming of Christ, the second appearance of Christ, as the writer of the Hebrew letter puts it. Every appearance of Christ is a coming of Christ, all right, but not every coming of Christ is an appearance of Christ. Let me give you an example of that in Matthew 10:23. You shall not, he said to his disciples, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel until the Son of Man be come. Well, he obviously wasn't referring to his second coming as we commonly refer to it. So not every coming of Christ is an appearance of Christ. And I come quickly in this trial is what I think he was referring to in verse 11. And in having the crown taken also in this verse means causing you to leave the faith. Let no man take thy crown. Only saints who are faithful to the end are saved. The crown of life, the crown which is life, as we have in James 1:12 and 2 Timothy 4 verse 8 and 1 Peter 5:4 and other passages as well. The crown which is life. It's an athlete's victory crown, not a diadem, but it's a laurel wreath, which is an athlete's victory crown. In Philadelphia, games and festivals were especially prominent on their inscriptions. They exemplify with unusual clarity here the importance that was attached to athletic prowess in this particular town. In fact, the stadium site can still be seen in the city of ancient Philadelphia. I will make him a pillar in the house of my God. The idea of the pillar was stability. It was firmness and support. They never knew when these quakes would come. They lived in a state of dread of disaster. But they would go no more out. They wouldn't have to worry anymore about the earthquakes, the aftershocks, the tremors that caused them to be camped outside of the city. In other words, this is a picture of complete and total security for these people. I don't know if you realize this, but Asian temples at this time were built to withstand severe earthquakes because they had these earthquakes so often. The foundations of these Asian temples were laid on beds of charcoal, and this charcoal was covered with fleeces of wool, which caused the structure, in essence, to float. Like a raft floats on the water, the temple was built on this foundation, so it would float on this foundation of fleeces and charcoal beneath. And each block then that was laid on top of the fleeces was joined by a metal clamp to the block next to it, but yet there was some motion allowed there, like you would allow a little bit of play when you put something on a tractor with a three-point hitch, allow a little bit of play so if you hit a tree or something, you don't just break everything. There's some sway allowed. And that's what was underneath these Asian temples that were built at this time. The platform was a unity, and yet, like a raft, it had a lot of give to it. So that, therefore, the temple would be the most secure structure in the city. And the promise to be a pillar in the temple of God was a promise of security and safety. In this city of brotherly love, apparently the church was living up to the name of the city. The church is the pillar and support, the pillar and ground of the truth, as the Apostle Paul puts it to Timothy, meaning that it holds up the truth. It's a lampstand that holds up the light, holds up the truth. Inscribed pillars are found throughout this area of Aegean Turkey. Today, we still continue to dig them up sometimes. Reference here in these pillars is also seen to the pillars Jachin and Boaz that Solomon built out in front of the great temple in Jerusalem as it originally stood, 2 Kings 7:21. The idea is that Jesus will write divine names as well as his new name on those human pillars who are overcomers. The city of my God calls to mind the names assumed by Philadelphia in honor of her various imperial benefactors, Flavius and Caesar. Contrast the symmetrical beauty of the heavenly city, as we read about it in Revelation 21, with the wrecked and neglected building of this existing earthly shaky city. Writing the name of the city on you represents citizenship. Didn't Paul say that our citizenship is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ? God has honored you. You, as a member of the Lord Jesus Christ, every one of you in particular being members of Him, you, as affiliating yourself with a congregation of His people, you have citizenship in this kingdom. You have citizenship. Not in Philadelphia. He's not referring to them as having citizenship in Philadelphia. That was just happenstance. And it's like you and I. You have citizenship in the greatest city there is. And I don't mean Lee Summit or Greenwood. You have citizenship in the greatest city that there is. Our citizenship already is in heaven. That's the point that he's making here. God has honored you in this way. The security of the heavenly city stood against the precariousness of life in Philadelphia. Philadelphia received a new name twice in the first century, and Jesus will write his name on those who are the property of Jesus. It means that you're identified with him. So today, as we have looked at this, and we're done looking at that letter now, we have to recognize that we live in a shaky, unsure, insecure world. Change and decay and all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Back in the Old Testament, the Lord said, I am Jehovah, I change not. There is no variableness, no shadow as though cast by turning with him. He is our eternal reference point. And we come together on mornings like this to refresh our memory, to remember him, refresh our memory, and keep that reference point strong with one another by our association together. We conclude by extending the Lord's invitation, which is open at any time. If you have something to bring before the church here, please let us know as we stand together and sing an invitation number.